Okay, so, like I said, we're gonna do learning behavior, intro to learning behavior here. These are really commonly used terms. I mean, every day we talk about learning, we talk about your behavior. That was a great behavior, or your behavior was unacceptable. Or, actually, I guess people that parent, you know, do this more, so. That's the kind of thing I say to my kids, you know, Elliot, your behavior is clearly unacceptable. He's like, what? Yeah, okay. So, well, take my course, you'll understand. All right, okay. So, what are they really, why are you not doing anything? Okay. Huh. That's strange. Right. Windows hates me. Not a surprise. I hate it. Okay. So learning. What's learning? Well, learning is an enduring change in behavior. What do we mean by enduring? We mean it's going to last for some time. You know, it may be permanent-ish. It may be, it's going to last for a relatively long time. All things considered, okay? So that's what I mean by learning there, at least within the field of psychology. Now, there's lots of things that can change your behavior for a long time. We are only principally interested in learning with respect to a change due to some experience, all right? Basically, when we talk about learning in psychology, we're talking about how something is done. So what were the processes of the learning? How often were you presented with a stimulus? How intense was that? What was the stimulus? Was it repetition? These sorts of things. So we're asking how questions at that point. When we talk about behavior, we're talking about the actual procedures or actions that are being performed. Now, again, some of these behaviors are going to be due to learning. Some of them are not. There's actually a lot more behaviors that are due to non-learning situations than due to learning. In either case here, we're interested when we talk about the behavior in terms of what is happening. So a rat pressed a lever with its right front paw. That's a behavior. You sat down in the chair when you came to class. That's a behavior. So those are the what's. We're going to cover a number of different types of learning here during this course. In psychology, the lay public just sort of says, well, you learn something new. It's like, great, yeah, that's kind of vague. Yeah. Scientists don't really like that kind of vagueness. It makes our teeth itch a little bit. So we tend to categorize things. So we're going to talk about four different areas, types of learning, and there's differences within each of these. So we're going to talk about habituation and sensitization. We'll get into that today. We're going to spend a couple of classes talking about, a couple of more classes maybe, talking about classical conditioning, good old Pavlov kind of stuff, salivate, you know, these sorts of things. Operant conditioning, so we'll talk about that, so reinforcement, punishment, these sorts of things. And we're going to talk a little bit about observational, or sometimes called vicarious learning. I think this is good because it's actually a stunningly interesting and important type of learning, which oddly here at the U of A gets kind of overlooked a lot. So I don't think you'll actually, if you go on and take 381, I don't know that you're actually going to do anything else with observational learning. But if you're interested in anything like development, for example, how kids learn, observation, linguistically, observation is big. So these are very interesting ones. Issues of autism, very tied up into issues of observation and what autistic kids are acquiring by observing others, or as the case may be, what they are not acquiring by observing others. So that's an interesting one. We'll come to that in towards the end of the course. All right. We exist in an environment which has a lot of change. Things change more or less constantly. I mean, our perceptions, it may not seem like they're changing, but there's a lot of change going on. Even actually, and this is a non-learning process here, but the angle of the sun, so goes across the sky, the angle of the sun actually, from a physics wavelength perspective of sight, changes the color of your clothing. Now, our brains have evolved to be able to cope with that. And so, you know, if you see your friend, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, and your brain goes, yep, your friend is wearing a red shirt, by 12 o'clock, because the sun's coming from a different angle, it's going to look like a slightly different color of red. Now, you could go, whoa, when did you go change? Because that's now more of a maroon color. And your friend's like, are you on crack? It's like, no. Okay, but our brains have evolved just to go, no, it's the same. It's the same red. It's the same shirt. Our brains account for that. That is a non-learning process. But again, something as simple as the sun. The sun isn't moving. We're spinning. You get the idea, right? That's a change. Okay, we have to be able to adapt to that, or we'd be very, very confused. Okay, so adaptation with respect to changing conditions is very important. Now, there's different time. Oh, yeah. What makes it non-learning? Because that's an excellent question. Why is dealing, coping with the different angles of the sun non-learning? Because you don't have to learn this. It's something that's innate. Your brain is just wired to cope with this. It's difficult to do these kinds of studies with really young infants, but there are ways we can do this with non-humans by controlling the kinds of wavelengths of light that they are raised under, until then we can set up a paradigm by which, you know, if you think it's the same, peck this and get some food. If you think it's different, peck that and get some food. And do the whole sun thing with say, chickens or pigeons. And we can see that without having any prior exposure or learning opportunities, they just get it. They treat it as the same color. So there's ways we can do this. But, yeah, it's a good question. Hypothetically, it could have been learned. And that's one of the real tricks with this branch of psychology is doing studies that allow us to distinguish between learned effects and non-learned effects. Good question. Okay, time scale. Depending on issues with the kinds of change we're dealing with, whatnot, there will be differences in the scale. So learning is great for some things. It's not so great for others. So environmental change, historically, has generally been rather slow, right? Large-scale environmental change, if we go back in time, might have taken hundreds, thousands of years. You're not alive that long, okay? You're just not going to be able to learn to deal with that. But from the evolutionary perspective, there's selective pressures that come in that can change behaviors over long times. So learning is just one type of adaptation, and it's generally dealing with a relatively short time scale, things that you will encounter frequently throughout your lifespan. Now, we're humans. Maybe a few of you think you're a bit post-human. That's okay. My cell phone and I are so merged, I've gone cybernetic. Okay, whatever. As such, we have this very human-centric view of things. Keep in mind, even things like fruit flies learn. They've got a very short lifespan relative to us, right? A few weeks, okay? But learning can occur there. So, you go, wow, fruit flies, humans, huge difference. Neuronally, not that much, actually. A lot of the basic learning processes, habituation, sensitization, classical conditioning, operant conditioning. These all occur in flies as well. They live days compared to our decades, and yet the same underlying learning processes work. So this is what I mean by learning is a relatively short-term process, maybe minutes, hours, days, may occur over years, but it's something occurring during a lifespan. And it's just one type here. Now, before we get into looking at the specifics of some learning systems, we're actually going to step back and talk about what are called innate behaviors. And there's been actually a great deal of research on this. Whole branch of the biological sciences called ethology, ethologists that have studied innate behavior patterns for a rather long time. Actually, the ethologists were going on things before there was any psychologists, or at least people that called themselves psychologists. Okay. Now, innate behaviors are evolved. They are evolved behaviors. These are behaviors that have occurred due to evolutionary pressures, due to environmental change over long time periods. So across lifespans. So across the lifespan. If this is a course in learning behavior, why are we bothering starting here? Well, there's actually some, what, nobody wondered that? Nobody. Oh, okay. I'm going to tell you anyways, because it's part of my banter, okay? There's good reasons for starting with some innate behavior here. We'll only talk about these really today here, but a lot of learned behaviors actually have their roots in innate behaviors. So we can kind of trace these back, if you will. We can see an evolution in how the brain was developing in organisms based on this. There are parallels then between many of the innate behaviors and the learned behaviors. And in fact, once we get into, say, classical conditioning, Pavlovian conditioning, we're going to have to talk about reflexes. Now, reflexes are innate behavior processes. Basically, classical conditioning is the ability to modify a reflex, to learn something, and thereby learn to produce a reflexive response in a new situation, one that you didn't evolve to deal with. We're going to take a look at a few things with respect to innate behaviors here. Homeostasis, talk about reflexes, some type of behavior patterns that are called tropisms, which basically deal with movement, locomotion, and what are called modal, or I prefer the older term, fixed action patterns. You can use either modal or fixed action patterns. So, real briefly, this bald guy, looking slightly like is Darwin, Charles Darwin. He wasn't bald when he was young. He's looking very serious here. I think he's wondering what happened to his hair and whether or not he's still sexy. He's not, but that's okay. So Darwin, interesting sort of history on Darwin. I've got a master's in history, so I sometimes veer off. I've also got a PhD in psychology, in case you're wondering why I'm up here. But just zoology, history, why? Where do they get this guy? No, I really do have a FUD in psych. Darwin came from a family of doctors. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a famous surgeon, also a poet laureate of England, oddly enough. Two things, you know. His father was a surgeon, and it was expected that he was going to be a surgeon. His older brother was training to be a surgeon in Edinburgh, best surgical university in the British Isles. And so, in due course, Charles was sent up to learn surgery. And this really wasn't working because he passed out at the sight of blood, which is kind of tough if you're a surgeon. So you make the first incision, and it's like, take over. And it doesn't work very well. So the secondary fallback position, his dad wasn't very happy with this because, in fact, he took a couple of years to tell his dad that he wasn't actually bothering to really go to his surgical classes. And I've been sending you money. What are you doing up here? So I didn't really want to say, but I think it probably involves a lot of pubs. Anyways, he gets sent down south in England. He's going to have a career as a fine, you know, it's acceptable. The Darwins were... They weren't nobility, but they were rich like nobility, okay? His grandfather, Erasmus, was like the equivalent of the surgeon to the stars. Like King George III wanted Erasmus Darwin to be his personal surgeon. So, I mean, he was pulling in the equivalent of millions of dollars a year, okay, in salary. They were set up, okay? So it was acceptable for a second son to be like a country pastor. And Darwin thought that was okay. Go off, get his theology degree, and, you know, he only had to work one day a week, really a morning, so that seemed to be pretty good hours. Do a sermon, wander around out in the country. What he really liked was stuff like bugs and rocks and plants. And interesting thing with the English university system was you registered in a program, but there were none of these, like, you know, FCE 3 credit requirements, must have 1-3 credit equivalent in physics, 1-3 credit equivalent, blah, blah. Now, it's like, he registered in theology, but no one told him what he had to take. There was no requirements. What would happen is after 4 years studying whatever, he'd have to pass his theology final exams. Now, these are not like final exams that we have now. These were really final exams. The professors could ask you anything that they thought you should know, whether or not you were taught it or not. And they went for about a week, like about 7 hours a day. And that was, you had pretty much no other exams during your undergrad, but at the end, you had killer exams. Okay? So the year before he's supposed to write these exams, Charles realizes, I haven't gone to any theology classes. I really don't like that stuff. What he's been doing is taking botany and geology and entomology courses, because no one was telling me he couldn't. And his dad is going to be pissed. Again. So he's offered this chance to hop on a boat called the Beagle and sail around the world for 5 years. And he thinks this is a pretty good idea, right? That's called running from your problems. But it works out well for him, okay? So this is the five-year voyage of the Beagle. And the, you know, classic story of how he encounters different species and Galapagos Islands and finches and whatnot. Didn't actually encounter the finches until I got back into, or see the connection, the importance, until I got back to the UK, but that doesn't really matter here. By the time he gets back, he's essentially got his idea of evolution. It takes him about 20 years to get around to publishing it, because he knows it's going to be controversial. Right. But he finally, in 1859, comes out with The Origin of Species. Talks about three things, three types of selection, artificial, natural, and sexual. Artificial, not really important from a biological world. It involves humans selecting traits in cattle or pigeons or dogs. Okay, so artificial selection, you want a particular characteristic. Has anyone read On the Origin of Species? No? It's actually a pretty easy read. He's writing it to appeal to a lay public from 1859, so I think you can probably handle it. He introduces things with artificial selection because the British were really farmers. Okay? They were an agrarian population, so people got that. Oh, yeah, you want to breed a speckled goat? Well, how you do it? Okay, so he talks about that. Then he talks about natural and sexual selection. Basically, in natural selection, you're dealing with characteristics that will increase your chances of survival. So under particular environmental conditions, if you have a trait which will increase odds of survival, odds are, or at least you've got a greater probability that that characteristic will be passed on, and over many generations, this characteristic will come to predominate in the population. Sexual selection, on the other hand, are characteristics that are, well, going to get you lots of sex, really. So if you happen to have some characteristic that makes you more sexy, then that characteristic will get you more sex, you will produce more offspring, and all of the things being equal, those traits will probably be passed on over the generations. It's a fascinating area, and I encourage you to learn more about it, and we can't talk too much more about it in this class. So, but really, what's happening here is we've got adaptation due to the environment. The environment is what is putting the selective pressures on species. Well, actually, on individuals within the species. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about natural selection really quickly, okay? Based upon variation, do I have any identical twins actually in the class right now with their twin? Cool. Okay. I can do this then. Look around you, and you will see that everyone is different. I did this a few years ago, and I actually had two sets of identical twins in my class. Going, we're not. What are the odds? Pretty low, as it turns out. So I check now. Anyways, they're all different. That's called variation. Okay. So in any population, there is variation. All right. Even in bacteria, it's due to mutation that there's variation amongst most bacteria. There's some other stuff going on as well, but generally variation. The fact that we're a sexually reproducing species puts massive amounts of variation into our species every generation. Second, inheritance. Okay, characteristics get passed from one generation to another. And finally, selection. Some individuals will do better than others. And by better, what Darwin meant was what he calls differential reproductive success. Differential reproductive success is not necessarily just having more offspring. If someone has, like, I don't know, you got some bunny that has 10 baby rabbits, and they all get eaten by a fox, whereas some other bunny has only one rabbit, but it goes on to survive and produce, another baby bunny rabbit. Who was more successful down the generations? The one that only had a single bunny baby. Baby bunny, bunny kit, never mind. You get the idea. So differential reproductive success is not necessarily just about numbers. Numbers are one way to do it. You can either try to have lots and lots and lots of offspring and hope that at least a few of them survive, or you can have fewer offspring and put more effort, energy, resources into those offspring. It's a fascinating issue about what kinds of environments and what kinds of species opt for the different approaches. Humans, people like to talk about humans actually being sort of the second approach, have fewer offspring, put more energy into them, but actually it's more complicated than that. It really depends upon the particular environment as to how this is dealt with. So humans are actually fascinating critters to study, much like rats. Anyhow, should say there's no intelligent design here, okay? There's no plan, there's no long-term goal, right? Evolution doesn't go, hey, you know what, I think I'll make, you know, largely naked apes that will be able to use cell phones sometime in the future. Cool. If things had been slightly different, some random occurrence, we could all look like giant lobsters. I don't know. Could have been very different, okay? So there's no long-term goal. Assuming that there's a long-term goal for things is what we call a teleological argument. It's bad, okay? Just take my word for it. Or if you've taken some philosophy of science, you'll know why it's bad. Selection occurs at the level of the individual. Didn't used to get taught this way. Even back when I was in zoology in the 80s, we'd often talk about evolution affecting the species. So, you know, ever seen any of these old or even sometimes recent nature documentaries where, like, wolves are chasing caribou or something? That kind of stuff? Discovery Channel loves them, okay? And it's like, now, go back a ways. It doesn't happen too often now, but it used to be, it's like, the wolves are closing in on the herd of caribou. One of them turns to face the wolves, giving the other caribou time to escape, valiantly sacrificing his life for the betterment of the species. Bullshit. No. That one caribou is going, dudes, guys, wait! If we all just work together, we've got these big things on our heads. We can stab the old crap. He's probably a bit lame, or he's gone slower, or he tripped or something, and he gets eaten. He's not doing it for the betterment of the species. Okay? Sucks to be that caribou. If you haven't already reproduced, you're a dead end, genetically. So evolution largely occurs on the level of the individual. Okay? You either reproduce or don't. Or your close relatives reproduce. So if you don't really want to be reproducing, then you better make sure that your siblings or at least cousins reproduce lots to get the equivalency of your genes passed on. All right. Last sort of point on this is it's slow. How slow is evolution? It's like, oh my gosh, slow. Okay? Generations upon generations upon generations. Skulls. Nice skulls there. So Australopithecine on the left, Homo erectus on the right, Homo erectus in the middle, Homo sapiens on the right. So going over the period of a couple million years here, we can see skull size has gradually gotten larger. And that's only one aspect of the physical evolution process that's happened through our ancestors. There's all kinds of other evolutionary processes that were occurring to, for example, lead to an increase in brain size. High-fat nutrient milk, for example, lactation change. There's interesting indications about different mother's body being able to determine whether or not the offspring she's nursing is a boy or a girl. And the actual type of milk differs a little bit depending on the sex of the infant. So very interesting things. There's a whole suite of physical evolutionary processes happening. Classical example here, just to throw a video at you. Okay. What you said.
Here are two skeletons of modern primates. This skeleton I'm sure you all recognize because it's a skeleton like yours and mine. This is a modern human. But the smaller skeleton is one of our closest living relatives, the chimpanzee. we began walking on two legs, and that made a whole series of modifications in the skeleton. In humans, the spinal cord comes out of the base of the skull and points straight downwards, rather than coming out of the back of the skull. The pelvis is shaped very differently. A chimpanzee has a long, narrow pelvis. Ours is short and squat. We walk with our knees close together. Chimpanzees walk with their knees wide apart. These are minor differences. These are the sorts of tinkering that evolution did to change us into a modern biped.
Okay. So, classic example of evolution of the physical system. Now, there's actually, going along with that, a whole series of behavioral evolutionary processes occurring as well. So evolution does not just act on the bones and the muscle and the endocrine system. It acts on the brain. When you look at it, all of our behaviors are really due to our central nervous system. And the central nervous system can be affected through evolutionary processes, or our behaviors can be affected through evolutionary processes. All right? So we get all kinds of things. And sometimes the physical form influences the behavior as well. In the brilliant depiction of human skeletons and chimpanzee skeletons, we talked about the pelvis shifting. So bipedalism shows up, and this actually makes it a lot more difficult to give birth. Chimpanzees don't die in childbirth, right? Humans do. Being quadrupeds, chimps have a much easier time actually birthing than humans do. So it's riskier for humans. And part of that's because of the increase, actually most of that is due to the increase in brain size. So we seem to have evolved bipedalism first, and then our brains started getting bigger, and then we had some problems. So there's a trade-off. The solution was for us to give birth prematurely. What do I mean by that? I don't mean like preemie babies that are born like 5 to 5 months, 6 months old. If you compare humans to other non-human primates, we should actually gestate for about 21 months to get an infant at birth that has the same self-sufficiencies and capabilities as non-human primate infants. So the guys may not quite grasp this. The women undoubtedly will. So we gestate for about 40 weeks, typically. 21 months of gestation. That's like producing a one-year-old child coming out of you. There we go! Oh my God! Yeah, that's like trying to give birth to something that's about 20 to 25 pounds. Guys, that's like trying to pass a basketball through your rectum. Well, it doesn't work physically. Physically, the only way that could actually work with humans is if males were bipeds and females were quadrupeds, and it doesn't seem to work that way. So the solution that evolved was to give birth early, which means that basically, when our kids are born, they've got about a year of catching up to do. They should still be being baked inside the oven, if you will, for another year, which means they're helpless, which means all kinds of behavior started being selected for. So cases of pair bonding, altruistic care, shared child rearing, cooperation. Okay, these are all things that our species is very good at. We do this a lot. Probably because if we didn't, most of our children wouldn't survive, you know, past the first like month or so. So very interesting stuff, how physical form can influence behavior form, and how some of the behaviors can then feed back in and alter physical forms as well. So fascinating stuff. But my point here is, in terms of adaptations, really, really, really slow. This isn't about learning. You can learn to be better at shared child rearing, but we have these innate predispositions towards it. Okay? You can teach people this, but they've got an innate predisposition. Or language, right? People have tried for decades to teach non-human primates language. It doesn't work. Well, at least it doesn't work very well. I mean, like, you know, Kanzi, the signing chimp, has got like a whopping 400 signs, something like that. So basically, Kanzi is operating at the level of kind of a stupid two-year-old, which is pretty cool for a chimpanzee. Okay, I mean, not to take away, from Kanzi, but chimps, they just haven't evolved the predisposition towards language. Great communicators, crappy at language. It's impressive that any of them are able to pick up the amount of language that, that they do. Human children, we're just behaviorally predisposed. Our kids just learn language. I got, how did I get so old? I've got three kids. And can't tell by my accent. I was born in the UK, and I did field zoology. It was my initial training. And field zoologists are pretty foul-mouthed individuals, actually, because when you're 200 kilometers out in the bush and your outboard motor breaks and all you've got is a pipe wrench and some duct tape, you swear a lot. And so, you know, my kids are predispositioned to pick up cursing from me when things don't go quite right. Probably explains one of the reasons why we homeschool, so I just have fewer parent-teacher meetings about them. Do you know what your son said? What? Oh, yeah. Well, at least he was using it right, wasn't he? Okay, I'll talk to him. Moving on. Okay, so evolution is another form of adaptation, but it's a very slow one. So great for the long term, not very good for the short term. Okay, so you can start to see how we need some abilities to deal with more of these short-term changes. Now, fortunately, evolution has actually produced some of these. Over these long periods of evolution, organisms have evolved that are able to cope with these short-term processes. Again, we're not talking about learning yet. We're talking about innate physiological or neurological mechanisms that allow these organisms, including us, to cope with short-term change. We'll get to learning in a while. Okay. So, concept of homeostasis becomes significant here. Homeostasis is just a kind of fancy way of saying balance. And what we're talking about here is homeostasis with respect to maintaining an internal balance of the bodily systems. There are drives. Okay, we can talk about drives. Drives are things where our bodies act in ways. They send us signals or whatnot that get us to do various behaviors. We are driven to, if you're hungry, driven to eat. Thirsty, driven to drink. Okay, we call these drives. Some of these drives are what we call regulatory drives. Regulatory drives are drives that if you don't do them, your body will eventually go so far out of homeostatic balance that you just die. Okay? So, the eating drive, the drinking drive, the seeking out warmth if you're cold drive, if you're a homeotherm. The sex drive, we talk about the sex drive, but it's actually not a regulatory drive, right? I mean, if you don't have sex, you're not going to die. You may feel like it, but you're not. Okay? You're not actually going to die. Do not try that as a pickup line in a bar. It's like, it's a homeostatic balance, baby. If we don't have sex, I mean, out of control, I'm just going to... Won't work that way. Okay. If nothing else, you're just going to freak the person out and it's like, I'm scared of you, and leave. Or you'll be pepper sprayed. Which leads to another regulatory drive. Eyes burning, must wash out. Okay. Actually, drive, not regulatory. Okay. So regulatory drives are a subset of drives. And these are the ones specifically that if you don't act on them, you're going to be in some real trouble. Now, anyone taking engineering courses? Yay! Okay, there you go. You want to come up and teach control systems? No, well, you probably do a better job than I would, but here we go. I'm going to talk about control systems. Control systems are a way of understanding how drives are controlled, regulated, modified, okay? Actually, you can think about this in terms of a thermostat on your wall. A thermostat is just a control system. If you're cold, you push the little lever up and your furnace comes on and your house gets warmer. If you're too hot, you push it down and the furnace turns off, and if it's the middle of summer, it has no effect whatsoever. That's where you need your air conditioner to come on. If you don't have one, nothing you can do about it. Okay. In a control system, and some thermostat is not a biological system, but biological systems, a.k.a. organisms, we can talk about control system theory in terms of explaining behavior processes. So, few things that are involved in a control system. A comparator. A comparator simply compares stuff. Okay, pretty straightforward. There's what we call a reference input and an actual input. They are input, they are information that goes into the system, so into the comparator. The reference input is, like, think about this. You set your thermostat, you want your house or your apartment to be at 20 degrees Celsius. That's the reference input. The actual input is a little thermocouple or thermometer there that says, oh, it's either below our reference, it's below 20 or it's above 20. Okay, so that's the actual. Then we got this thing called an action system. It could be a small action system, it could be a big action system. In the case of the thermometer, your action system is going to be like everything that connects up to your furnace. Okay, so wires that go down and get the furnace turned on or off. The furnace then pumps heated air through your house. Okay, so let's go down. Action system. And there's going to be some output. So the output is what your action system actually does. And then we have feedback. Okay, so if your furnace is actually working correctly, it starts pumping heated air out through the ducts. The temperature inside your house or your apartment goes up. At some point, the actual input is at or above the reference input. And that sends another signal to the action system to turn off, shut down the furnace. So that's the feedback. In this example, we're talking what's called a closed-loop system. Don't worry about that, okay? Just for all you engineers. There is going to be some response time lag, okay? So there's a bit of lag. It takes a little while for that furnace to shut off. It takes a little while for the thermocouple in the thermostat to register the new temperature. So sometimes there's a little bit of delay, so things don't always seem to happen instantaneously. Let's take a look at blood salinity. So, you know, get away from our thermostat here in our apartment into actually a biological system. So we can imagine that we have some comparator. Somewhere in our body, we have got some sort of biological comparator in there. Some of our nervous system, some of our endocrine system, physiological system, okay? So our comparator here is going to measure the amount of salts in our blood. It's called a blood salinity comparator. There is some reference input. Okay, this is our idealized level of blood salinity. Okay, on whatever scale we're using here, don't really matter for the purpose of this demonstration. Okay, so that's ideally where we'd like to be. So much salt per liter in our blood. There's some way that we measure this. Okay, our bodies have the ability to measure the saline in our blood. So that's our actual input. Actual input's coming in. How much salt is actually floating around in our blood? What's our blood salinity? Okay. So that's the information that comes in. And let's just say that perhaps there's a little green arrow that's popped up there. Let's say that for whatever reason, we are way below the reference input. In other words, you're really craving something salty, right? Okay. So, there's going to be some output here. It's like, whoa, actual input way below the reference input. Must increase salt. And if your salts drop too low, you have all kinds of problems. Your muscles stop working correctly. Your nervous system starts. You twitch a little bit. There's all kinds of bad things that can happen to you here. So we need to keep this within a relatively narrow homeostatic range, or basically you just don't work quite right. All right? So, output. So we see that the actual is below the reference. What do? Output gets sent out. We must get salt into the body somehow. Lots of ways to do this. Some of them involve, you know, hypodermic needles and saline drips, but most of us don't decide to, I'll just put up this bag of saline and decant it straight into my veins. Most of us say, we'll eat something salty. Peanuts, pretzels, whatever it happens to be, chips, okay? That's our action system. Now, in this case here, our action system could be rather complicated, a whole series of behaviors, right? Must go to cupboard and get chips to eat. uh-oh, don't have chips in cupboard, must go to store and buy chips, or friends having a party right now, could just go to friend's house and eat peanuts, yes, or whatever, okay? But there could be a very complicated series of actions involved here. That's okay. Control system theory allows that to happen. So let's just say we've decided we're going to eat some peanuts. Okay, that's our solution. Okay, so we've eaten some peanuts here. After a little period of time, the salts and the peanuts get into our bloodstream, and so now our actual input has moved up a little bit. We're closer to reference, but we're still a bit below our actual. So what do? Eat more peanuts. Okay, and again, after some lag, demonstrated by the few seconds it took for the little arrow to change there, we now have exceeded our reference. So you'll, yay, we now have enough saline in our O, but maybe we have a bit too much saline. We've got a little bit too much salt in our, a little bit too much salts in our bloodstream. So what do? Well, obvious solution would be drink water, okay? So you drink some water, and this will bring you back down. And so you see there's a feedback. This is going to toggle. I mean, you know, your level of salts in your blood are going to be, hopefully, if you're keeping things in homeostasis, hovering pretty close to your reference input. Doesn't always work. What if instead of opting for the solution of drinking water, what if you drank beer? Sweet, sweet, glorious beer. The lime on a balcony in the sun. What's beer do? Good God, do I have to take you people on a field trip? All right, going to the pub. Right. Well, it's a diuretic, right? So you start drinking beer, and then you have to go pee. And what's that done? That's just dumping water out of your system. So the salts are going up, but, you know, it's also affecting your nervous system. So instead of saying, maybe I should drink some more water, you go, I'll just order more beer. Bad judgment there, right? All right, so you get even thirstier, so you'll drink more beer, and then pretty soon you're wearing a lampshade on your head. Right. Okay, so, comparator system. Let's take a break. Okay, so come on back in 10 minutes, so a couple minutes after the hour, and we will continue and get into reflexes.